Okay, so this is Bio 160. This is our last class. And you just took your last quiz, number 14. And I'll tabulate all your scores and put it on Blackboard. And when I do that, I'll send you an email. And I want you to go there and check your scores because I'm going to drop two lowest quizzes. And I will do that manually. So I might misread your row and drop one of your higher quiz scores. So you got to double check, make sure, right? Because it's just a human doing that process right there. So make sure I drop your two lowest quiz scores. And of course, I'll bring it on Thursday as well. And so I won't have time to do it today, probably tomorrow sometime. So it's going to be really close to when you take the next test. And maybe I'll have it ready just in time for the test. I'm not sure. Okay. So it's going to have all your quiz scores. And the quiz scores that I drop, it's going to have a number and then a little D after it, meaning drop. And since it's in Excel, if there is a cell that has a number and a letter, then it doesn't get added up because it's not really a number if it has a little D behind it. So that's how it's going to calculate your row of quiz scores. Okay, so look for that email. All right, so I think we're almost done with the male reproductive system. Okay, maybe not quite. Oh.
Oh, no.
That means I do have to find out how to fix the power. Okay. Well, let's see. Let me disappear into the back room and see if I can put about power on this thing. New. I guess we're really lucky we have lights in some of the rooms. No circuit breakers. Yeah, no, I was just sitting here and all of a sudden all the lights just went out and came back on. So something happened right before class. All right, so I'm going to draw some stuff on the board. Yeah, I know. That's the way it is. All right, that's actually more fun anyway. Let me see if there's anything here. Nope, nothing. Okay, so let's review something about reproduction. Let's start with a cell. Here is a typical cell. What's the name of the genetic material that's inside the cell? And where do we find it? Chromosomes, and where do we find, and chromosomes are made up of DNA, right? So DNA or chromosomes, where do we find chromosomes? Inside the nucleus. So I'm not going to draw the nucleus, I'm just going to draw a chromosome. So how many chromosomes does a human have compared to other animals? 46. All right, so there should be 46 chromosomes inside normal cells of your body. And some cells will divide. All right, so if we start with this single cell, it's going to divide into two separate cells, and it's going to have 46 chromosomes in there. So what kind of process is this? This is what we looked at way at the beginning of the semester. This is what we call mitosis, right? Mitosis. So these are what we call daughter cells. And what's the difference between this daughter cell and that daughter cell? Nothing. And this daughter cell and this parent cell? What's the difference? Nothing. So you could think of them as clones. And sometimes we actually talk about them as being clones when we look at immunology. for instance. So this is mitosis. This is what we call asexual reproduction because the daughter cells are exactly the same as the parent cell. There's no difference between them. And you know the phases of mitosis. What are the phases of mitosis? Yeah, ipmat. So it's interphase is when the cell is growing. Prophase is the first one. Metaphase, anaphase, and telophase. Those are the phases, and probably you need to review a little bit what's going on in there. All right, so these are what we call somatic cells that make up every cell in your body. So you have 46 chromosomes, but more importantly, you actually have two sets of chromosomes. You got a number 1, a number 2, number 3, all the way down to 23, and the same over here, number 1, number 2, number 3, all the way down to number 23, and we add these together, you get 46. So why is it that you have two sets of chromosomes?
Mom and dad.
Yeah, because you had a mom and a dad at one time. Even if you don't have a mom and dad right now, it's one point in time you had a mom and a dad. Right, unless you're a test tube baby. Anybody a test tube baby in here? All right. Okay. But you still probably had a test tube dad at least. All right, so at one point in your life. All right, so one of these we call the mom chromosomes, and the other we call the papa chromosomes. Okay, but that's really what? Maternal and paternal. Right, so you got these right here. So what the heck does a chromosome really look like? All right, a chromosome is kind of looks like that, kind of looks like a bow tie. And these are what we call chromatids. So here is one chromatid, here is a second chromatid. All right, so let's put a chromosome inside this parent cell, and let's put just that same chromosome over here and over here. So we're just talking about mitosis. How is it that this one chromosome right here ends up as a single one here and a single one here, and both of these daughter cells have one? What has to happen to this thing first before it can undergo mitosis? Yeah, it has to, what we call, replicate itself, which means it has to duplicate itself, because if we split this thing in half, we've got to double it first so that we end up with the same thing again. So in that process of replication, this is what happens during interphase, it replicates itself. And during the process of mitosis, what happens? These things separate. Okay, so these are what we call sister chromatids. So one sister chromatid goes up onto this cell and the other one goes down to this cell right here. Okay. All right, another terminology. This number one chromosome is very similar to the paternal number one chromosome. And the maternal number one is very different from the two or three or four, even in the same set. All right, so number ones are very similar, number twos are similar. So these chromosomes right here are what we call homologous chromosomes. Homologous chromosomes. Okay, so now we're going to start talking about another process. Well, I tell you what, before we get away from mitosis, what good is mitosis? What is it for? Two important reasons. This is just a review. I'm not quite sure I heard what you said. Oh, replenishment. Yeah, I like replenishment. That is what, to replace old and damaged cells. So you could use that term, replenishment. But that's to replace old and damaged cells, like skin cells that you're losing all the time. How many red blood cells do you lose every second? Yeah, over between 2 and 3 million every second. So mitosis reproduces those red blood cells so you don't run out of red blood cells and become anemic. And also, at one point in time, you were just a single cell. Does anybody know what that little cell was called? It's got a special name. It's called a zygote, right? And when that zygote gets big so that you can come to anatomy class and take notes, you need to what? Get bigger. You need to grow. So mitosis allows for growth to happen as well. So growth and to replace old and damaged cells. All right, so here is another process. So going from just a simple chromosome, a simple single chromosome, to a replicated chromosome, that's what we call replication. All right, so let me draw another one in right here. And you can see that these are very similar, just different in color. So let's just say that the blue over here are the paternal chromosomes. And here is a process where this cell is going to split, and it's going to produce four cells instead of just two. And in each of these four, there's not going to be 46 chromosomes, but there's going to be 23 chromosomes. Okay, and they might look something like that. So this process, which is a nuclear reduction going from 46 to 23 chromosomes, producing these things here, which we call gametes, which have half the number of chromosomes. What's the name of this process? Can't be mitosis. This is meiosis. All right, so this is meiosis. And what do these things look like? What kind of cells do these look like? Yeah, these are sperm because they have this nice flagellum on there. They're motile. They can swim around. And so any kind of sex cell is what we call a gamete when it has half the number of usual chromosomes in it. So I want to talk about meiosis just a little bit. There's another kind of gamete. What's the second kind of gamete that we have? Eggs. That's right. Eggs or oocytes. Oocyte just means egg cell. And these here are sperm. All right, so sperm and eggs are gametes. Eggs are from females. Sperm are from males. And they're all produced by a process called meiosis. Okay. All right, so where am I going to draw? I'm going to draw an egg. So here's an egg right here, 23 chromosomes. All right, so these can join together to form this single cell, which is the union of these two right here. And we said, what is this thing called? That's a zygote. Right? And we were all a zygote at one time. Okay. And so if this is a zygote, what is this process called? That is fertilization. Okay. So we got mitosis to get big, meiosis to make gametes, right? And fertilization to make something new and unique, which is what? A combination of female and male characteristics. All right, so here's fertilization. All right, here's fertilization. I hope you can see way back up there in the back row. Probably. Okay, so don't forget, for mitosis, we just have these phases. Yep, mat. All right. Well, we have a similar kind of scheme for meiosis. Okay, there is prophase, metaphase, anaphase, and telophase, but not just one of these phases, there are actually two. So there's something called meiosis one and something called meiosis two. So let me show you what's going on there, but I'm going to have to erase the board. So let me erase mitosis, unless somebody doesn't want me to. You didn't speak up fast enough. Okay, so there's two rounds for meiosis. The first thing that happens, all right, this is going to split into two cells, like this. And what's going to happen is one cell gets one of the set of homologous chromosomes, and the other one gets this chromosome. So this is what we call meiosis one. So what splits during meiosis one? What did we call those things? Those are homologous chromosomes. So homologous chromosomes split during meiosis one. All right, and then, and I'm just going to draw one of these cells, and then this cell splits into two. All right, so furthermore, we have 46 chromosomes in this parent cell. After meiosis one, what do we have? We're already down to 23. But the chromosomes are replicated. There's two copies of every chromosome. All right, so this over here is what we call meiosis two. And guess what splits during meiosis two? the sister chromatids separate. So you end up with this situation right here, plus what? The other two from this cell right here. Here and here. So you end up with 23 chromosomes in every cell. So what do we call these guys over here after meiosis two? These are all what we call these cells right here. What do we call all these cells? These are gametes. Okay? And that looks kind of like an egg to me. That can be fertilized with a sperm cell, which is a gamete, right? And that gets you back to 46 chromosomes. So that's kind of a long discussion of meiosis one and meiosis two, and you basically only have to memorize what's going on there. So I could ask you on the test, what separates during meiosis one? And the answer is homologous chromosomes, right? It's separated into these two sets. And for meiosis two, what separates? The sister chromatids. All right, but if you have a little picture in your mind, then that might make it easier to answer those questions. Okay, so that's how sex cells are produced, via meiosis. Okay. And you have a pretty good picture in your book that shows that too, right here. Okay. All right, let's talk a little bit about male physiology and hormones. Let's go down to number three, testosterone. Testosterone is secreted from the testes. Maybe I'll have to draw this on the board. All right, and it stimulates spermatogenesis, which is meiosis, the production of sperm cells. It causes development of male genitalia, external genitals, causes development of the male duct system inside the body, and produces male secondary sex characteristics, like more hairy body compared to women, coarser hair. All right, skin is thicker and stronger. It's harder to rip because it has more collagen in it compared to females. The larynx, and where's the larynx at? Yeah, right here, that's the first part of your lower respiratory tract. There are vocal cords in there. The larynx in males, because the testosterone is bigger, the vocal cords are thicker, and so it produces a lower voice compared to females. And testosterone produces an elevated hematocrit, which means the red blood cell count in males typically is maybe 2 or 3% higher compared to females. And testosterone also increases muscle mass. Right? And so testosterone comes from the testes. All right, but the testes won't secrete testosterone unless they get a signal from another place. And that other place is the pituitary, the anterior pituitary. The anterior pituitary releases two hormones. One is called luteinizing hormone, or LH, and that causes the interstitial cells to secrete testosterone. So what's another name for the interstitial cells, and where do we find the interstitial cells? Interstitial. That is, they're outside the seminiferous tubules, right? They're outside the seminiferous tubules in the testes, and another name for them are the Leydig cells. And luteinizing hormone stimulates those interstitial cells to secrete testosterone. The other important hormone is follicle-stimulating hormone. This is the one that acts on the germ cells inside the seminiferous tubules and causes them to undergo meiosis. And FSH also stimulates the Sertoli cells because activity of the Sertoli cells is necessary to support spermatogenesis. All right, and then lastly, LH and FSH are what we call gonadotropins because they work on the testes, all right, and that's from the anterior pituitary. And the anterior pituitary is always listening for signals from the hypothalamus. And the hypothalamus releases GnRH, which is gonadotropin-releasing hormone, and it causes the release of GnRH from the pituitary. So, in lieu of showing you a slide, here's the brain, okay, and not the scale, here's the pituitary gland. Your pituitary gland isn't that big. And about in this region right here, you have the hypothalamus. And here is the pituitary, and here is the anterior pituitary gland. And then, of course, way down over here, you have a testes. And you have blood circulating between all these different places. All right, so there is a hormone secreted by the hypothalamus that controls the anterior pituitary. All right, I can change colors. So here is a hormone that goes to the anterior pituitary. What's the name of this hormone that causes a secretion from the anterior pituitary? The name of the hormone from the hypothalamus. We're going to call that GnRH. That stands for gonadotropin-releasing hormone. So the hypothalamus releases or secretes releasing hormones, which always go to the anterior pituitary, and it causes the anterior pituitary to release two hormones that go to the testes. And those two hormones are LH and FSH. Okay, so what's the effect of LH on the testes? Yeah, goes to those Leydig cells or interstitial cells. So that is right here, causes them to release what? Testosterone. And FSH goes to the seminiferous tubules and produces and supports and stimulates spermatogenesis. Okay, so here's just a little graphic of what we just talked about. You got the hypothalamus controlling the anterior pituitary controlling the testes right here by these different hormones. And testosterone, right, feeds back to the brain, and the brain knows what the proper level of testosterone is. And if the level of testosterone is too low, the hypothalamus is going to release more GnRH, which is going to cause the release of more LH, which is going to cause the release of more testosterone. And when testosterone reaches the right level, the hypothalamus says, okay, I don't have to secrete so much GnRH. So the hypothalamus is controlling the level of testosterone in the body via that control system right there. Okay, so I think that's it for the male reproductive system. Now let's go to the female reproductive system. Okay, and I won't put my marker down. All right, what's the what's the function of the female reproductive system? Yeah, new and unique offspring, right? Okay, and the primary sex organ in the female is the ovary. That's the counterpart in the female to the testes in the male. And, of course, spermatogenesis does not take place in an ovary. Oogenesis is happening there, the production of eggs. And oogenesis is a fetal process. All right, so in terms of spermatogenesis, a male through their whole life will be producing sperm. I don't think anybody's ever counted how many sperm a male will produce in their lifetime. Okay, but a female, when she's born, will have all of the possible eggs that she will ever be able to produce in her lifetime. In the fetus, the female fetus will have about 750,000 immature oocytes, which is probably plenty because I can't imagine anybody wanting to have more than 750,000 offspring anyway, right? So it's fine that women don't produce eggs through their whole life period, okay, compared to males. When a woman is born, okay, she's born with what we call primary oocytes or follicles in the ovary. But by the time she's born, about 400,000 of those eggs will have already died. And then by the time that she reaches puberty, she'll have about 300,000 left, okay, that will develop into a functional gamete. But that's still plenty, right? Who wants to have more than 300,000 babies anyway? Does anybody in here feel left out for that reason? No, obviously not, okay? And then once a month, a secondary follicle will mature into... I'm pointing to it like you can see it. You can't see what I'm pointing to. Yeah, right there. Okay, a secondary follicle is going to develop into a mature follicle, which means that that follicle can spit out an egg at mid-cycle. All right, and that egg is a gamete, and then it's ready for fertilization to take place. Okay, when a follicle is developing during the first part of the ovulatory cycle, it secretes a hormone called estrogen. Okay, so in the male we have testosterone, and in the female we have estrogen. So here is an ovary right here, and here are some developing follicles. I'm not going to draw all 300,000 of them in there, but once a month, one or two of these follicles will start to mature and form a mature follicle, and inside that mature follicle is an oocyte. All right, the ones that start maturation but don't make it to maturation just regress and die. All right, but there's plenty of primordial follicles in here to where that can happen every month. Then right at mid-cycle, this oocyte, okay, is ruptured from the follicle. And that's what we call ovulation. All right, so during this process, when a follicle develops and gets bigger and bigger and bigger, it's releasing primarily estrogen. And estrogen produces the secondary sex characteristics of a woman, as well as it coordinates events within the uterus, which is what we're going to talk about in just a little bit. All right, so after this mature follicle ovulates, you still have the mature follicle inside the ovary, and it doesn't go away. It becomes another important endocrine gland, and this is now what we call the corpus luteum. And this one right here is what we call the mature follicle. Okay, so in time, what separates or what changes a mature follicle into a corpus luteum? What's happening between being a follicle and a corpus luteum? This is ovulation. Yeah, so ovulation separates those two different phases. Right, so here is ovulation. Okay, and so we said follicles secrete primarily estrogen. The corpus luteum is going to stop secreting estrogen and secrete another hormone called progesterone. And there's no counterpart in the male. Males don't have anything that looks like progesterone. And progesterone is necessary because it works on the uterus to make the uterus kind of quiet. So another name for progesterone is progestational hormone. What is gestation? Pregnancy. Yeah, pregnancy. That's when somebody is carrying a fetus, right? And during that time, the uterus should be strong but relatively quiet. It shouldn't be irritable, shouldn't be contracting, right? Because that might terminate the pregnancy. So progesterone maintains the lining of the uterus, the muscle of the uterus, and it keeps it quiet so that the baby can go to term. Estrogen, on the other hand, stimulates the growth and development of the uterus in preparation for implantation. Okay. All right, well, let's talk about, I think, some of the anatomy of the female reproductive tract. Ooh, I could have kept that. Okay, female reproductive tract. What was the primary organ? Ovary. Okay, and ovaries kind of look like that. Kind of has these little lobes on it, because what's associated with each of these lobes right here? A follicle is in there, right? Or maybe a corpus luteum, so it has a very wavy kind of surface. All right, then, of course, right about here, we have the uterus. And in between the uterus and the ovaries, we have these tubes. Bless you. Okay, and these tubes right here, these are passageways for this egg that gets ovulated. All right, it's a passageway for that egg to reach the uterus right here. All right, so this is what we call a fallopian tube, or maybe a uterine tube. Okay, and of course the same on this other side over here. Notice that this ovary is not attached to the fallopian tube, but the end of this fallopian tube just kind of hangs over the ovary, and it has not just a straight flat surface, but it has a lacy surface, or these fingers projecting from the fallopian tube, and we call these fimbria. So here is a fimbria. Uh-oh, that's not spelled correctly. E? A-E? Okay, check the spelling on that. Fimbria is plural. Fimbria, or one is fimbria. And these things are sweeping over the ovary all the time. Okay? And does this egg have a flagellum or cilia or anything like that? No, it does not. So this egg is not motile. It can't move around by itself. So how does it go from the pelvic cavity down the fallopian tube, or into the fallopian tube, down the fallopian tube, and then into the uterus? How does it find its way there? Well, if this egg is over here in the pelvic cavity, even if the fallopian tube is contracting, okay, it's not going to affect this egg in the fluid of the pelvic cavity. Okay. And the reason is because the epithelium that lines the fallopian tube and the fimbria is ciliated. It's a ciliated columnar epithelium. So what do cilia do? Yeah, they all sweep in unison, right? They beat, and that causes a flow. They all sweep toward the uterus. That causes a flow of fluid down the fallopian tube into the uterus, and this egg just gets carried by that flow down through the fallopian tube. Okay, fertilization, as far as we know, usually takes place in the fallopian tube. But that's okay, because sperm can do what? They can swim around everywhere. All right, so here we have vagina. And between the vagina and the uterus, there's a dome-shaped structure. Okay, that makes the uterus, and we call this the cervix. Right here. Do you have fornices on your diagram? I guess I could look. Do you have a fornix on your diagram? Do you have to know what a fornix is? You don't. You just have to know what a cervix is. Okay, but these little indentations around the cervix are what we call fornices, right? And don't forget, it's a circular structure. All right, so sperm here can swim up through the cervical canal into the uterus, all right, and up into the fallopian tube for fertilization. All right, but where else can they swim? They can swim all the way out the fallopian tube, anywhere in the pelvic cavity and anywhere in the abdominal cavity, right? Because that's just open to the pelvic and peritoneal cavity, as long as these sperm are healthy. All right, so we said that this egg can move down the fallopian tube due to what? The cilia. Okay, and That's a relatively delicate kind of cellular feature or cellular structure. And if anybody has had an inflammation or an infection of the reproductive tract, it's going to damage the function of these cilia right here. And when the cilia are damaged, what happens to the motion of this egg or the movement of this egg down the fallopian tube into the uterus? Okay, it's going to be impeded and it might even be stopped. So that this egg is just going to float around in the abdominal pelvic cavity. But what about those sperm? They don't care if those cilia aren't working. They probably have an easier job, right, because they don't have to swim up against the flow that's sweeping down toward the uterus. And so this egg, right, can be fertilized in the pelvic cavity or the abdominal cavity, and it will implant into blood vessels that supply the intestines. And maybe if there is a blockage, if there's a scar of the fallopian tube right here, maybe some sperm can get through, but this egg can't. The fertilized egg or zygote could implant into the fallopian tube or into mesentery. And the fallopian tube and mesentery doesn't have the muscles necessary to maintain pregnancy. It has blood vessels, so the zygote can start to grow and divide by mitosis, right? It starts to get big, but when it gets heavy enough, it rips away from that blood supply and usually causes a massive hemorrhage at that point in time. So what do we call that when implantation doesn't occur in the uterus but happens in a fallopian tube or maybe in a mesentery someplace in the pelvic cavity or abdominal cavity? That's what we call an ectopic pregnancy. Right, and of course that's deadly when that happens. And for years and years and years, that was missed in many emergency rooms because a female would come to emergency room and say, oh, well, I have some kind of pain in my side over here, and it's kind of a nondescript pain. And somebody would say, well, gee whiz, we can't really figure out what it is. It might be appendicitis, but it's not acute enough. Why don't you go home, take some aspirin, and if it still hurts in the morning, come back. All right, and what could happen then? Well, they would never come back because that ectopic pregnancy would rupture and the person would bleed to death very rapidly, just within a number of minutes. Okay, and in order to prevent that from happening, they would actually hang signs in the emergency room. And that is, the sign would say, think ectopic, so that if a woman of childbearing age, sexually active, would walk into the emergency room with nondescript abdominal or pelvic pain, then that's something that they would investigate right away. They would look for certain hormone levels or do some kind of imaging studies to see if there was an ectopic pregnancy and, of course, save the woman's life. Okay, so I think you should be a little bit aware of that because most women I know, when they realize that they're pregnant, okay, and have some abdominal or pelvic pain, they try to minimize it, all right, but you should take it seriously and get it diagnosed by your OBGYN person, all right? And so anybody with a history of pelvic inflammatory disease, that is always a complication of pregnancy. You should be aware of that and be followed very closely. But it's easy to follow, all right, because when this blastocyst implants, it's going to start secreting hormones day after day, and the levels of hormones should always be increasing. All right, so that's really easy to tell, hormones in the urine. And if for some reason the hormones level off or decrease, that means then that pregnancy is dying because it hasn't implanted in the correct location, and then that's a sign of an ectopic pregnancy, and you have to find out where it is. All right, and that saves your life when you find that out. Okay, so that's the importance of, you know, any kind of pelvic inflammatory disease, because when you have an infection, that forms scar tissue. So this also is a nice illustration of a functional and structural relationship between the fallopian tube. It has to have the right structure in order for it to perform the correct kind of function due to those cilia. Okay, the uterus. Now, why does the uterus do its job? All right, well, the uterus is pretty thick. It's got three layers to it. Here is the perimetrium, And then the muscle layer right here is what we call the myo, for muscle, metrium. And then there's an inner layer right here where implantation takes place. This is what we call the endometrium. That's the endometrium. That's where implantation takes place. Yeah.
I have a question about
ectopic. If you say you don't have any damage, is it possible to have that type of pregnancy? Ectopic pregnancy? Yeah, but it's remote. Okay, because usually those cilia, you know, will function pretty well. But there, you know, there might be something that can run in a family that somehow decreases that motility. Yeah, I would say prenatal care is always important for that. So under any circumstances, if you know you're pregnant and you have pelvic or abdominal discomfort, you got to find out why, because it could be an ectopic pregnancy. Okay. Other reasons. Well, why might you have pelvic inflammatory disease? Sometimes when they place an IUD, an intrauterine device, as a contraceptive modality, sometimes the placement of that IUD in the uterus causes infection. We don't know why that happens, but that's just a risk of using that method of birth control. Okay, and then it will have a tendency to scar the fallopian tubes. Okay. If we look at this fallopian tube right here, when people first started looking at it, they said, oh, it looks like a musical instrument. And so what kind of musical instrument does that look like? Okay, it looks like a trumpet, okay, to some people. I know, maybe not the way I drew it. I should have drew it. I wasn't thinking ahead far enough, but a trumpet, okay? And in Greek, the name for trumpet is salpinx, like that, salpinx. So in some circumstances, we call that a salpinx and not a fallopian tube. And if somebody has had pelvic inflammatory disease and maybe there's a blockage right here, and a blockage right here, and it fills up with fluid, so it kind of just forms a balloon right there instead of a nice narrow tube. We can actually take an x-ray or some other kind of imaging modality and image what the fallopian tube looks like to see if there are blockages or if there are distensions of the fallopian tube. And that's called a hysterosalpingogram. Right, a hysterosalpingogram, and maybe you've heard of that, and you probably were wondering, well, where did that term ever come from? Okay, it comes from that term salpinx. So hystero means you get a picture of the uterus as well as the salpinx together to see what it looks like in an image. Okay, to see if it can function fairly normally. All right, so you got the layers of the uterus. Okay. During a normal menstrual cycle, one of these layers is sloughed off, all right, and is expelled from the body with a mild hemorrhage. So what layer do you think that is? Perimetrium, myometrium, or endometrium? It's the endometrium, right? So it gets sloughed off of the body, and sometimes that causes problems because sometimes those cells are still viable, they're still alive, and they might move, for whatever reason, retrograde up the fallopian tube and into the pelvic cavity, and they might not die. And that tissue might grow in other parts of a woman's body, and we call that endometriosis. And that tissue can proliferate during the cycle and then regress and come back, and it can actually be fairly painful for some women. Okay, but we don't really consider that a tumor, but it almost seems like a tumor because it's cells that have originated from the uterus, but they don't migrate into, for instance, the brain or liver or bone or things like that. They pretty much just stay in the abdominal pelvic cavity. Okay, so we got cervix, cervical canal. What's the strongest muscle in the human body? What do you think the strongest muscle of the human body is? This one right here? Biceps, pretty good. Leg muscles? Okay, but to me, obviously, it's got to be the uterus and in particular the cervix right here. Okay, and that's kind of shocking when you think of that because we could think of like the strongest man in the world and give him a barbell that's 9 pounds and say, okay, put your arm out like that and hold it there for 9 months. What would happen? No way. You couldn't even hold it there for a day, right? But a woman during term, right, has to hold that fetus in so that cervix is extremely strong. Okay, so I got a question for you, and that is having to do with cancer. We talked a little bit about cancer, and endometriosis really isn't a cancer, but there is an important cancer in the female reproductive tract. And so I'm just wondering, would you consider cancer a sexually transmitted disease? Is cancer a sexually transmitted disease? Some people say yes. Okay. And some people don't know necessarily what to think. Some people are saying no. And in my opinion, the answer is yes, it is. Okay. For the following reason. And this is really unfortunate because there's about 7,000 women in the United States that die of cervical cancer every year. Remember when we talked about colon cancer and why it's a shame all those thousands of people die of colon cancer? Why is it really a shame that all those thousands of people in the United States die of colon cancer? It's preventable. It's easily detectable. And if it's detected early, it's 100% curable, right? And the same thing for cervical cancer. It's a slow-growing cancer. It's even slower growing than colon cancer. Colon cancer is very slow-growing. You have years to detect it, find it, and cure it. Same thing for cervical cancer. You have decades to find it, but it's missed. So how would you diagnose cervical cancer? With a pap smear, okay, just a yearly pap smear. And now there are even some more sensitive chemical tests. And what they're testing for is an infection due to a virus. And that's called human papillomavirus. So there are over 100 different strains of human papillomavirus, and we now know today that four of these strains can cause changes of the cervix, which eventually lead to cervical cancer. Okay, we call those dysplastic cells. They can be seen with a pap smear fairly easily. And then if they are noticed on the cervix, they can be eradicated with just a little cryoablation surgery, just a little liquid nitrogen on the cervix, and those cells get killed, and which is a really nice, simple procedure, and the woman never comes down with cervical cancer. But if those cells are ever diagnosed on a cervix, of course, you need the proper follow-up with that, right, to make sure that all the cells were missed. Of course, it's easy for me to say cryosurgery of the cervix, but don't forget that even for prostate hypertrophy or prostate cancer, that's one of the surgical techniques that can be used, which is cryosurgery, which is freezing just a part of the prostate that is cancerous. Okay, and the only way to get a human papillomavirus infection is by sexual contact, all right, from an infected male. All right, so in my opinion, absolutely, cancer is a sexually transmitted disease, right, particularly of this cervix right here. All right, there are a couple different reasons that somebody could come down with cervical cancer. One is sort of interesting, and this is a result of something that happened maybe 40 or 50 years ago. There was a time in certain women that had difficulty going to term. They would lose a pregnancy, and their estrogen levels were bolstered by a shot of estrogen, but a synthetic kind of estrogen called diethylstilbestrol, or DES. And it worked, but unfortunately, what we found later on in life after the baby was born, if it was a female, those females had a tendency to come down with cervical cancer. All right, so that treatment with steroids in utero produced cancer in the daughters of these women, you know, 20 or 30 years later. All right, but again, since now we know that, it's very easy to follow these women, right, and it's easy to treat them because cervical cancer is so easy to treat. All right, the latent period for cervical cancer, I said, could be decades, could be 10 or 20 years. So if you're a middle-aged woman and you have all your children and all of a sudden you come down with cervical cancer, you can't just go to your husband and beat him up for being unfaithful because you don't really know where the infection came from, right? It could be from previous 20 years. If you were sexually active at that time. All right, so, and you know what? They came up with a vaccine. Anybody know the name of that vaccine? It's called Gardasil. And we don't know exactly how effective it is for preventing cervical cancer, but it seems to be pretty effective for at least a few of those strains of viruses that will protect women. But I think last week I saw in the news that there are some side effects that are appearing in women that have had the Gardasil vaccine. So it remains to be seen if it's safe and effective. We don't really know yet. All right, so that's something about the female reproductive system. We got vagina, okay, uterus. You have urinary bladder. Here's urinary bladder. And to the outside world, there is a tube. So what's the name of this tube from the urinary bladder to the outside world? Urethra. Okay. The urethra and vagina never merge together to form the same structure. So the female reproductive system is always separate from the female urinary system is always separate from the female reproductive system. It never joins. Unlike the male, where you saw it join there at the ejaculatory duct where it meets the urethra. Okay, but this area right here is what we call the vestibule. And the vestibule is the opening of the vagina and the urethra. Sometimes those openings are what we call orifices, an opening of a tube. And then the female also has some erectile tissue about here. That's the clitoris. And protecting the vestibule right here, so the vestibule is this cavity, the vaginal orifice, the urethral orifice, the clitoris, as well as some protective tissue. Right, and there are two layers. This would be the labia minorum and the labia majorum. Right, and labia just means lips. These are lips that protect the vestibule. So the vestibule is what? This whole area over here. The orifices, the clitoris, labia minor, majorum, and that cavity right there. All right, so that's pretty much the female reproductive tract. Let's see, what are some things that I might have on the test that we have to cover? I don't know if I have anything on the breast on the test. That's interesting to look at. You know, you might want to look at that page, page number 6. There are two hormones that have to do with the production of milk. Okay, so during pregnancy, the placenta is the tissue that's formed when the fetus tissue mingles with the maternal tissue and forms like the lungs, right, for the baby. That's where oxygen exchange is taking place. But the placenta is also an important endocrine gland that secretes estrogen and progesterone. And those estrogens and progesterones travel through the maternal circulation to the breast, and it causes development of glandular tissue of the breast. So that is during pregnancy. Okay, and then when the baby is born, something else happens. So the baby is going to try to nourish itself by nursing, by suckling on the breast. And of course, the mom can feel that. And there are nerves that go from the breast to the hypothalamus. Remember where I had the hypothalamus? That's in the brain. And the hypothalamus is going to signal the pituitary gland to release another hormone called prolactin. Right? So what stimulates this reflex is suckling. And prolactin then causes that glandular tissue to start producing milk. So right at parturition, the breast is not competent or is not able to produce a competent milk product. It can secrete something, but it's not milk because it hasn't been stimulated by prolactin for a day or two. And that product is what we call colostrum. That's an incompetent fluid that the breast secretes. It has reduced fat, doesn't have very much sugar, but it does produce antibodies. So colostrum does have antibodies, so when a nurse feeds or suckles for the first couple of days, they're at least getting some immunohelp from their mom. They can fight infections because of antibodies that they get from the mom via colostrum. All right, then after a couple days, there is another hormone that takes effect. All right, so now the breast has developed during pregnancy. The glands have been told to start producing milk because of prolactin. All right, but that still doesn't allow milk to be released from the breast, and that's what we call the milk letdown reflex. All right, so there's another reflex, and again, that is stimulated by suckling of an infant. There are nerve fibers that take signals to the hypothalamus, which go to the pituitary, in this particular case, the posterior pituitary. And the posterior pituitary releases a pretty powerful hormone called oxytocin. And oxytocin travels through the whole body, and it causes smooth muscles to contract, particularly of the breast, the ductal tissues of the breast. So when that smooth muscle contracts, that secretes milk from the glandular tissue of the breast, and we call that the milk letdown reflex. And that's sort of interesting because what do you think happens to the fetus, not the fetus, the newborn baby, okay, when it starts to nurse and all of a sudden there's milk present on a nipple? What happens to the infant? Does it get bored? Does it fall asleep? Or what? No, it's very stimulated because it's receiving nourishment, right? So it becomes, the infant becomes activated, right? And when the infant becomes activated, do they nurse more or less? More, which produces what? More stimulation, more nervous stimulation to the hypothalamus. Hypothalamus tells the anterior pituitary to secrete more oxytocin. When there's more oxytocin, that produces more letdown of milk. And what happens to the infant? Do they get bored? No, it stimulates the infant even more, which stimulates, right, more milk letdown, which stimulates the infant more, right? And we're talking about two different kinds of feedback mechanisms. One was a positive feedback, one was a negative feedback. Negative feedback is what happens when the response counteracts the stimulus. That's negative feedback. That's usually what produces a natural environment, a homeostasis in your body. But in this circumstance, okay, milk letdown produces more milk letdown, which produces more milk letdown. So there's positive feedback right here. So this is an example of how positive feedback works in an everyday, well, not every day, but almost, right, an everyday occurrence, right? And we call that milk letdown. Due to positive feedback, the milk letdown response is a positive feedback mechanism. Okay. Some terminology. You know, I might have some of this terminology on the test. And we are probably familiar with the menstrual cycle. Okay, so once every 28 days, a reproductively capable female will lose the endometrium, right, with a mild hemorrhage. And we call that menses. Right, so you should know what the definition of menses is. But that doesn't occur from birth. That happens at puberty. And so the first occurrence of menses is what we call menarche. So menarche is the first occurrence of menses. That's highly variable. It could happen anywhere from 10 to 16 years of age. And it's a gradual process. Doesn't have to happen overnight. Okay. Menopause, on the other hand, is the cessation of cycling at mid-age. It could be, again, a very wide range of years. It could start as early as 35 years, or it could extend, in some people, up to 50. And again, that's a gradual process. And if you're interested in yourself, when you might reach menopause, you should probably look at your mom and aunts within your family to get a feel for family history as to when that might happen to you. Okay, so know those definitions for menarche, menses, and menopause. And who can tell me why we call it menses and menarche and menopause, and why not womenses? Or womenarche? Or womenopause? I have no idea. Okay, but somebody should find that out one of these days and let me know. Okay, and in the let's just talk about some hormones real quick. So the woman has a couple of important hormones. In the male, we talked about LH and FSH. All right, so here we have this follicle, and what stimulates this follicle to develop from these primordial follicles to bigger and bigger and finally into a mature follicle is FSH, follicle stimulating hormone. So follicle stimulating hormone causes follicles to mature during a menstrual cycle, and right at mid-cycle, we have this process. What is this process? When a mature follicle spits out an egg, that is ovulation. And ovulation is controlled by the other hormone, which we call LH, or luteinizing hormone. So FSH causes a follicle, one follicle, or maybe a handful to develop, and usually only one reaches maturity during the menstrual cycle, and then a big surge in LH causes ovulation so that egg can be fertilized. So LH and FSH are important in both the male as well as female physiology. Okay, well, I think that's about it because the next picture I got is pretty complicated and I can't draw it. So that's it. So when's our test? Thursday. Our test is Thursday. And I think you got all the materials you need on Blackboard. Okay. And I'll grade the quizzes right away. So if you want to see what grade you got on your quiz, you can meet me by the T-Rex skull outside.